Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to the Free Cities Podcast, episode number 27. I'm in Lisbon again this week, and I'm talking with a gentleman by the name of Federico Fernandez. Federico is the CEO of Somos Innovación, also known as We Are Innovation, which is a network of more than 30 think tanks based in Latin America and Europe, dedicated to promoting progress through innovation, the adoption of new technologies, and human creativity. Now, unsurprisingly, the main focus of our discussion today is innovation in all of its many incarnations. We examine the eternal struggle between regulation and innovation and dive into some of Federico's opinions on inventive governance models, in particular Estonia and its innovative e-governance system. I hope you enjoy the conversation. If you have any comments or feedback, please get in touch via our social media channels. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, or even on Getter. There should be one there for you. I'm always happy to hear suggestions, especially relevant people you think we should interview on the podcast. Anyway, that's all for now. It just leaves for me to say, please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Federico Fernandez. Have you just come from your talk at LibertyCon?
Yeah.
What was it about?
The relationship between innovation and regulation, and, you know, how, let's say, how to avoid that regulation destroys innovation.
Well, there's a good starting point then. Yeah. First of all, according to you anyway, what are the most potent places we find innovation at the moment? As in, you know, the kind of places you're working.
Well, that's a very good question. I would say still the home of innovation is the US, by far. There are, of course, pockets of innovation everywhere, and technology, particularly, you know, internet, cell phone networks, and they allow to build upon of them, and there are amazing examples and new business models everywhere, but the US is at the helm, for sure.
That's interesting. I would have assumed that there's quite a lot of regulation in the US compared to somewhere like China. Is that even correct? I don't know.
I know, I wouldn't say so. Let's say regulation could be cut all over the world. But keep this in mind, the Jeff Bezos of China, Jack Ma, was put in jail because of what he said. Imagine if either Trump or Biden would put Jeff Bezos in jail. Better said, would kidnap Jeff Bezos because of he said something, because of what he said about the government that they didn't like. Not long ago, the Financial Times published I only read the headline because it was more than enough. Published a headline that said something like this. The Chinese government liberated some expert in a field because they need more innovation in that area, and he was in jail. So,
right,
I think that's a very rough of regulation.
I was going to say the harshest form of regulation. Okay, so USA is the most innovative place, right? And are we going to assume that that's to do with the USA being a sort of federal experiment compared to everywhere else, let's say the newest version of a governance model that, you know?
That's a good question. Well, there are a lot of, let's say, ingredients to this cocktail. John Chisholm, who is, you know, an innovator himself, he's also a venture capitalist now and a very successful entrepreneur. he used to talk about the qualities of Silicon Valley and what made Silicon Valley what we know now it is. And there are a lot of things that have to do just with the inner culture, the culture of the place that were not that, let's say, it's not that easy to create a Silicon Valley, in other places. There are, for instance, one of the things he was mentioning, which may sound that a small thing, but I think is extremely important, is this idea of job hopping. John was, stressing that particularly in the early years of Silicon Valley. It was very, it was nobody would be surprised if, you started one job, then is, changed to another startup because it was more appealing. And that was and that created, a very, a way of interaction that, and the ecosystem.
And that was a new thing in Silicon Valley, do you think?
That was a very typical thing from Silicon Valley is, in many industries, let's say, if you see a resume of someone who has been changing jobs constantly, in many industries, that would be seen as something, detrimental, not as someone, I want to hire this person because, it's so creative. And he was comparing to an experiment, I think, in near Boston. Boston has a lot of amazing universities, has the MIT, I believe it's there. But there were certain cultural features lacking there. He attributed to that the failure. I think it was Route 21, the project in Boston, but I may be inventing the name. So those things are important. Of course, the institutional structure of the US definitely is more important, and also particularly we are in Europe right now when we are recording this podcast. In Europe, the precautionary principle has become some sort of very dangerous dogma. In the US, not yet, at least.
I was thinking about Silicon Valley, maybe. Silicon Valley has a culture of the kind of break fast. The move fast and break things culture is probably in alignment with the notion of jumping jobs and hopping between things. But I think that's probably something that in that startup world you kind of have to do, because it's 99% of all those startups fail anyway. In older legacy systems that have been well ingrained, you have, less need for it. And I suppose, how does Europe then compare? How does Europe stifle innovation then compared to somewhere like, the US, if the US is such a hotbed?
Definitely we'll go there. And we could be talking for a couple of years about that subject, but just a quick footnote to what you said. I totally agree. And the relationship towards failure is also, something, for instance, in Silicon Valley was totally understood, and nobody would think less of you because you had a startup and it failed. Then it's not that you're a failure. It's that, 99% fail, and that was completely understood. Again, compared to more traditionally industries and traditional views in general, in my country, in Argentina, in Latin America in general, of course, in the young people, these things are changing. But, having failed in whatever project you wanted to do, it's a little bit of something like a bad mark, something that... And definitely not in Silicon Valley, that was completely understood. Yeah, you tried to do something, it didn't work.
But before we do the Europe thing, I think I'd quite like to go into this and work out why that is, because... it does seem counterintuitive. I agree. Failing at something. I mean, the truth is, and we all know this, that you succeed by learning from your failures. But I think 99% failures is probably a little bit too many to learn from, isn't it? I don't know. Is that just a symptom of the tech industry, which is very fast moving? I mean, I'm just thinking about right now where I just... went onto Twitter to check what the latest AI tools are. And already I feel completely out of date from last week when I thought I'd started applying some AI onto my podcast, and I thought, this is phenomenal. It's doing this for me and that for me and this for me. And then this week, it's like, oh, shoot. There's one thing that'll do all that and more, you know, and it's like, you know, so maybe it's a symptom of the tech industry that, you know, you expect 99% to fail, unlike the banking industry where you don't actually expect one failure almost, or the many other industries.
Yeah, that definitely is when you are like in the frontier of a field, it can happen that you're not going to succeed. That's definitely the case. And the other thing is also that in many cases in technology, that failure also left you way wiser than, and that is also recognized. And the other thing is, you know, many people who fail at startups may end up, I don't know, working at Google, you know, and not necessarily doing their own thing, but they learned a lot in the process. It's very common for, I don't know, guys who studied, I don't know, at the University of Chicago, you know, they did a master in administration, business, an MBA that is probably one of the best regarded in the world. And one of the things some of them do is, I don't know, they are hired by a big company who wants to try some sort of new business model or business idea, I don't know, maybe in Colombia, and they go there. If they make it, they'll become billionaires probably. And if not, they learned a lot, and that will be valued in their next job because they tried something. So the other thing that, just to think about it, I like to reflect, particularly when I see, I don't know, old people working or, you know, I always like to reflect and keep in mind how difficult it is to earn a living. That, which means providing something of value to someone else in order to support yourself. And sometimes we lose, you know, sight in perspective about that. Particularly, unfortunately, governments and regulators many times forget about that and make the lives of those people impossible. And really, just really when you think about that, hey, I'm going to provide something, a service, something that is going to be liked by enough people that it's going to support myself and my family. That's very difficult. I mean, that it's doable, thank God, but that's very difficult, and that requires a lot of work. And, you know, there's AI that can do, you know, what you were providing a magnificent services, and now AI does it for free or for, you know, just $10 a month. So there are a lot of things that go on. And we have to keep that in mind as well. And that, again, can be a reason for failure. And it's not, you know, that you are doing anything wrong. It's just a situation and things changed.
I agree. And I think it is possible to add value in the world these days. But I'm probably wrong here. I'm probably looking through a sort of narrow lens at this here. But I do feel it's becoming harder. Personally, now that could be because I'm set in my ways. I'm 52, you know. I have a set of skills that I've honed over my life, and they're good. I'm good, really good at the things I do, but those things are probably devolving away. Now the question is, will there be will that vacuum be filled by something else, and younger people are looking at the world going, actually, there's quite a lot I can be doing here. What's your interpretation of whether or not providing a service is getting harder?
I see what you mean. I think, you know, every disruption, whatever you can think of, brings, you know, a period of instability. On social media, you know, you see a lot of things. I remember not that long ago on Twitter, there was a video of a robot that cleans toilets. And somebody put, you know, as headline, think of all those jobs gone. And I was thinking, thank God.
Yeah, me too.
It was damn time, you know, that this happened and these jobs are gone. I am extremely optimistic. You know, when you see how improductive, but at the same time, how much our parents or grandparents, you know, work. I mean, because it's not that they were lazy, or, but really all the things they had to do, that, you know, those things were, have been automized, or they, you know, those jobs are gone because they are done somewhere else, or, you know, industries have taken what was done in a very, you know, manually fashion. I think those changes have been all for the best, and I think they will continue to be. I mean, this is a, you know, just to show you how optimistic I am. I have two children who are about to turn 1 year old. They are twins. And I was, and I, thank you very much. And I was telling my wife the other day that I think, you know, they are going to end up living in Mars probably. I mean, that is the, I think that is the kind of world that now is opening for us. There are, of course, some people, you know, I don't know, who are afraid that AI will take over the world, will destroy the world, it will turn into Skynet. I think we had more, you know, more probabilities than Facebook or Google would turn into Skynet than AI. But anyway, I don't think so. I think there is something that you have to, you know, always keep in mind. If you bet on the end of the world, you can only be right once. You know, really, the odds are against you. It's just, it's one shot, you know, and I am not in the team of the doomsayers. I think AI is going to be a fantastic tool to help us in many ways. And I think completely new horizons are opening for mankind. And I think they are going to be mostly amazing. And really, I really think that you know, the babies of today are going to be pioneers in space, for instance.
Yeah, I'm almost certain we're going to go to Mars. I don't know how quickly we're going to go to Mars. I certainly don't think I would want to go to Mars. Maybe that's something that the sort of younger generations would find more enticing. But I love the planet, you know what I mean, in quite a visceral way. And I love nature, and I love, you know, the thought of living in a colony on Mars doesn't really excite me. Maybe that's something that would be so second nature to us in the future that actually, you know, it's something we do. All right, let's go back to how Europe stifles. You seem like you had a big list of things you were about to tell me all about, and I'm interested to know, since we are in Europe, I do live here. I live in Wales. You're living in South America, or are you here?
No, most of the time here.
Right. Okay. So it's relevant then.
Indeed. Yeah. Europe. Let's say Europe and the European Union. Let's talk, because the issue is the European Union. I think the European Union, in many ways, has been an amazing institution. I think many countries have not self-destructed thanks to the European Union. I think it was, we have to remember how the European Union was born, which was, you know, let's say the predecessors of the European Union can basically be dated, you know, the day after Second World War ended. And it was created by, you know, probably titans, you could say, who by the way, they were also, all of them were Catholic, you know, that's interesting to keep in mind. But in any case, I am not in the EU bashing. I am not in the idea that the European Union is an evil institution or anything like that. Having all saying all this, that I really think I admire the European project in many ways. The European Union is, unfortunately, trying to turn Europe into something that does not exist and will never exist, which is a regulatory superpower. You know, you can dream about that. Today at the LibertyCon conference, somebody, sorry, I cannot quote this person because I don't remember who he or she was, but somebody said, repeated this, you know, something that it's been said many times, that is, the US innovates, Asia copies, Europe regulates. And that's, you know, from that triangle, that's the worst part by far. And Europe basically, I mean, make the following exercise. Think anytime something new and cool comes up. immediately some European politician or public official is trying to ban it, run an investigation about it, or, you know, frowning upon and, you know, making faces, you know, and crying about it. Basically, it's all the time. It's with whatever. Think from...
ChatGPT has been banned in Italy, isn't
from
it?
From e-scooters to ChatGPT. Yeah. Anything, you know, it's susceptible to be banned in Europe because some whatever strambotic reason. And that is, let's say, that kind of mindset and like starting points about, you know, how you approach innovation are extremely dangerous.
So what's that all about then? Why is that triangle in existence? The innovate in America, copy in China, regulate. The China bit I get. Seems easy, seems obvious, but why is it, what is it about the European project that makes people, is it because the innovation is not coming, therefore, by default, and the innovation is not coming, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know? The innovation is not coming, so therefore when it comes from outside, it's a threat and needs to be regulated. I mean, I don't know, is that a fair theory?
I think there's a part of that, for sure. Let's say my assessment about this thing is the following. I think Europeans are extremely innovative, you know, individuals. And there are a lot of examples. Unfortunately, most of them, of Europeans living abroad, not being in Europe. That's it's not, let's say, a problem that, oh, you're European, therefore you cannot innovate. No, there's innovation. The issue with innovation, as I see it, is like this. Innovators are a part of the ecosystem. But the ecosystem is wider, and the ecosystem includes social views and institutional norms. In the European Union, unfortunately, in many cases, not all of them, and there are some positive that we could talk about too, but that institutional part and also how innovators and innovation is perceived is really against innovation. So that is the big issue. Of course, when, let's say, if I invite you to my house, but I tell you, hey, I have a tiger walking around, you know, the floor is a minefield and I'm not going to feed you or even give you water, and you don't come to my house and nobody comes to my house. They go to the neighbor's house because, you know, it has a lovely house, you know, with normal people and, you know, no wild animal is going to attack you. Yeah. I'm not going to thrive, probably. And that then comes what you mentioned. Yeah, you don't become a hotspot for innovation. On the contrary, you become and you end up being like this very sad and frustrated person that is always raising, you know, their finger and saying, but, you know, this is going to end up the world, but this is bad because of this or that. E-scooters are, you know, e-scooters have been banned in Paris. I mean, because apparently there have been something like 300 accidents in the accident. I'm not saying deaths, you know, or you know, people losing a leg or an accident. When you check, of course, there are certain things that can be done better regarding e-scooters, which are amazing in many other ways, but when you check how many people die per year in traffic accidents in France, you should be first banning cars and motorcycles. But innovation is way easier to bully because it's something new. It's easy to present as, you know, all the numbers are very easily overblown. And of course, there are no lobbies for what it's not yet, you know, what hasn't become yet. And that is another issue that in Europe is, let's say, very well established, that, you know, the incumbents have very powerful lobbies.
So at We Are Innovation, then, your company, what do you actually do with regards to innovation? Are you just promoting it, the ideas or these kind of ideas, or how are you helping innovation, let's say?
We basically do three things, I would say. The first one is a public work, that is to we have both published and we are currently working in different kinds of indexes that, you know, measure different things in order to explain what's going on in a certain area and how it could improve, we write reports, we write articles, we have our own podcast, we produce, you know, videos. We're doing videos, by the way, with MetaHumans, which is
AI humans,
which is very cool. Yeah. it's really amazing.
I know.
And let's say all that is the public, you know, advocacy and research part. We also try to keep open channels with members of parliament, regulators, public officials, politicians, and different, you know, stakeholders in this area, basically to try to warn about the risks of overregulation, of banning technologies, of the risks of overusing the precautionary principle. Our approach, and we're very clear and blunt about it, our approach is what Adam Theurer calls permissionless innovation, which is basically unless you can build a very strong case. And regarding harm, I mean, in the most, you know, like physical way, you know, meaning of the word, unless you cannot build a very strong case against a new technology, a new business model, this should be let to exist, and citizens, you know, consumers should decide whether they adopt it or not. Not faceless bureaucracies, maybe applying regulations that were written 20 years ago. I like to quote this example because I think it's very telling. At one point, I think in 2019 or 2020, Uber was kicked out of Colombia. Then they could come back, but they were kicked out using a very dark, you know, and opaque regulation written in 1998. In 1998, of course, Uber didn't exist, but not even the iPhone existed, the smartphone didn't. This is like for, you know, banning Starlink, the internet satellite company of Elon Musk, arguing, you know, the regulations of the telegraph. Starlink is not using Morse code or something like that, therefore it shouldn't exist. It's insane, and this happens all the time. So, and the third work that we like to do, we like to be in contact with innovators itself, with entrepreneurs. We try to interview them. We try to, you know, let's say, put the spotlight on them. And we try to also be very optimistic and positive in our approach. Sometimes we have to be critical, but we are never destructive. We try always to be part of a polite conversation and of a debate that hopefully will get us closer to the truth.
What about innovation in governance models? Is that do you go anywhere near that, or is it more like innovation in things?
We have, as you know, innovation is a very wide concept. We have picked certain areas, but we try always to be very open. The only issue is you don't want to spread so much that you're very thin everywhere. In governance, of course, we really admire private cities and all those projects. We have been more in contact just because of, you know, let's say certain issues, not preference. We have been in principle more in contact with the Estonian experience regarding e-government. We really like that approach. We have been doing several things regarding that. We would like the Estonian experience to be better known and ideally applied in more countries. That this idea to treat, which is, I mean, besides the technology and the Estonians in this, every one of them that I have either talked to or listened to or read to, they always say that it's a matter that goes way beyond I mean, it's not related to technology in principle. It's related of how do you think a government should, which kind of relationship they should have to their citizens. And for instance, that they have this mandate that, you know, I think they call it only once or something like that, you know, the state cannot ask you for your name more than once or for your address more than once. You know, if one agency ever had your address, for instance, the other agencies, in case they need it, they have to get them themselves. It's not that you have to go and fill these forms, you know, and go in and get first the blue mark and then the seal and then this. This idea is just, hey, you are our citizen, we should work for you too. We should make our your life easier, that you can create a company in 15 minutes, probably less. But that's what they claim, it's 15 minutes, I assume it's less. It's basically... And the other very important thing, that this has nothing to do with e-government, but I think it's one of the most revolutionary things the Estonians have done. You don't pay taxes, you don't pay income tax until you make money. If you open a company, it's again, and this is related to how difficult it is to earn a living. You have a project. You are putting probably some money that you could gather yourself, ask your family, risking it, trying to get clients. I mean, it would be great that you open a company and you have, you know, 65 clients, you know, lining up to give you. It's never like that. You open this company. You're trying to test whatever idea you have. Why the state should demand you to pay taxes in order to exist? Because it's basically, if you're not making money, it's basically you're paying a tax that allows you to exist. That thing that, I mean, it's very common sense. Well, Estonia is one of the very few countries in the world that has such a tax system that you, yes, eventually you will pay, but first we'll let you make money and get some clients and get some income.
That's interesting. I didn't know that about Estonia. Obviously, I know a little bit about it's an attractive place to go and start a company. Can you go a bit deeper into Estonia? Tell me a little bit about what you know or what you've experienced and, you know.
Estonia has a lot of admirable features. Some of them I've mentioned. Another, let's say the two very distinctive aspects of what Estonia is doing is one is the tax system, and the other one is the system of e-government. The tax system is, they have a flat income tax, which is 20%. But, as I said, if you are not making any revenue, or you are reinvesting whatever you have gained, you don't pay taxes on that. You only pay taxes the moment you give yourself a dividend, or you know, you pay a salary to yourself from your company, the money that stays, let's say, at the company's, you know, account, so to speak, that is not taxed. And I think that's completely fair. That doesn't mean that you're going to evade taxes or anything like that. It's just that if you are not getting the money to yourself, you're not paying any taxes. That's one of the fantastic things. And the other thing is really that the flat tax is a very clear and transparent and fair system. The enemies of the flat tax is very funny. I mean, they lack, let's say, and I'm definitely not an expert in mathematics or anything like that, but let's say there's always this mantra, whoever has more should pay more. Well, if you are making $1 million per year and I make 100,000 and we pay a flat rate of 20%, you are paying way more than I am. I mean, it's just that the state and the government is not penalizing you for making more money, and especially for growing. Because when you have, you know, a progressive tax system, one of the things you're doing is penalizing people for doing better. So, with everything that we just said, how difficult it is to earn a living, how difficult it is to improve your situation. Once you've done all that, which is very difficult, the state says, no, sorry, now you have also another hurdle, which is I'm going to tax you even more. In Argentina, this has become so crazy that people have refused to get pay raises because they would enter in the next category and they would in their pockets more less money, which is absolutely insane. But that this happens, and this is an Argentinian economist defines it as the government give you a handoff, which is a rugby maneuver that, you know, when somebody tries to tackle you, you know, you literally put your hand in their faces and try to stab them. So that is amazing about Estonia. Very tax transparency. The taxes are very easy. You can literally do your taxes in like 3 minutes. So everything is online. This is when, you know, the tax system and the government interconnect. Simple, easy, transparent, fair. And the second thing is the e-government system, which basically allows you to have whatever relationship you have with the government online, extremely comfortable. But, and this is also key, when they made all these reforms, the idea was not. Currently in the government, let's say, we have 1 trillion regulations and things that the citizens have to comply with. So we're going to do this online. So instead of, you know, going, you know, a million times to public offices, you have to devote, I don't know, the 100 hours per year or 200 hours per year in the comfort of your home in front of your computer or cell phone trying to do that. No, the idea was, let's radically reduce and drastically eliminate a lot of red tape to make it as easy as possible. That is why e-government, and I've seen this particularly in Latin America, e-government is not a very popular concept in many countries, because many countries, what they have done is basically, oh, now you can download this ridiculous form that you have to complete every year, every 6 months. Now it's a PDF and you can download it and print it. Yeah, I mean, it's an advancement, you could say, but that is not the key issue, and why Estonia works so well is because they used it to radically transform and improve the kind of things that citizens have to do with towards the state. So those things are amazing. And let's say on top of this, the easy taxes and the e-government, they created the Estonian e-residency, which is, I mean, the name is a little bit misleading, but the idea is that no matter who you are and where you are in the world, you can do a very simple bureaucratic thing, and you can get an e-card, which is an identification that allows you to open a company in Estonia, pay taxes in Estonia, do everything. It gives you all the economic rights that an Estonian citizen has, but you can do it from wherever you live. The misleading thing is that, let's say, it's everything except of a residency, because let's say that doesn't grant you the right to live in Estonia, but grants you the right to operate as if you were Estonian. When you think that Estonia is a full member of the European Union, you can basically, it's like your, you know, your company becomes a citizen of the European Union based in a country that is very friendly to business, and it has a very simple tax code and a very simple government regulation that you have to comply with. That is amazing. Many other countries now are trying to do similar things, and I think that these things are great. But let's say the simplicity of Estonia and how well the e-government system runs, it still gives them an advantage in this area.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though, with regards to tax, for example. Becoming an e-resident of Estonia doesn't grant you their tax rate if you're still dwelling, for example. Like in my case, in the UK, I think part of the way they decide who you pay tax to is where you spend the most amount of time. So, but I presume there are some countries where that's not the rule. So you could position yourself in Estonia without actually being there and pay tax to Estonia, or is that not the case?
That's a good question. Not necessarily. And the Estonians are very clear about this, and I understand why they are, because, you know, they don't want to be blacklisted or anything like that. Depending on what you do and how you run your company, you may have to pay taxes in Estonia, but that doesn't, if you are based, let's say, in Uruguay or whatever, in Zambia or whatever, you have to check what your local go, because you are still a citizen and a taxpayer in that country, you have to see what your local government. So it's still, I mean, it's a great system. It doesn't solve all the problems, unfortunately. But for many people who want to open a company, let's say many people who want to sell services in the European Union or even to the US or to, but want to open a company in a serious jurisdiction with good rule of law, with, you know, an easy environment to do business, it's a great opportunity. It's not the, you know, it's not the perfect solution for everything, but it's a great opportunity.
Are you au fait with any other different governance innovations currently happening? I mean, that's the kind of our interest at Free Cities is governance models, and I mean, we see that at the Free Cities that are being tried out in Central America are attracting this exact type of person, someone who wants to start a business and wants to potentially create a regulatory environment that might be even new and innovative. So can you talk to any other places that you know of or any other situations that you've sort of looked into?
I'm not an expert, but I really like what's going on in certain Gulf area countries, you know, the UAE in particular. I think what they have achieved is amazing, and how they have transformed their country. Of course, Dubai is the example that really comes to mind, but it's not only that. And there are interesting developments in all those countries. And I think it's something that we should keep an eye on. And I'm not saying they are not perfect, definitely. And there are many, everywhere you have to improve certain issues, but I think they are in the right trajectory. And one of the key issues that they are trying in many aspects is to try, and this in the best way possible that you could understand it, they are trying to treat their citizens as clients. And that I think it's a fantastic approach. So there, I think there are interesting developments. In Europe, you know, well, there's this very small country, Liechtenstein. I think they are doing amazing things. And the rest, I think that the most innovation that we are going to see in the near future will come from more, you know, like newer alternatives, such as, you know, what's going on in Honduras with Prospera and other things. We are going to see really... Because the kind of arrangements that you can create there are you can really go to the frontier in the best, you know, meaning possible of the term. In other places, it's more complicated. And another thing that, by the way, I just recently was discussing in our podcast is the notion of mobile voting and how, for instance, how it could improve the situation in the US, particularly regarding primary voting, and how now both parties, the Republican and the Democrat party, they are in a way hijacked by the most extreme members of the party. Very few people vote in the primaries, and the ones who vote tend to be the most ideologues. And, you know, giving people alternatives and make it easy to vote could perhaps make the discussion come back to the center. And that I thought it was an interesting, you know, idea to consider.
What about private? I like the way you described the countries as having the public as their customer or their client. So what about the idea of a private place where you literally are the client? Like, do you think it can happen? It can work. It you know.
Yes, I do. I'm fascinated by the idea. I my first contact with such a kind of thinking, I would say, came from the book of Robert Nozick, Anarchy State and Utopia, particularly the last part in which Nozick talked about how a classical liberal society should work, which is basically with private organizations that, you know, private societies that you join if you like what they have to offer. And I always thought that was, I mean, once you read it, it seems like a very obvious idea, but that's, you know, that's one of the features of something that is truly genius, that, you know, once after you read it, as after somebody came with that, you think, of course, this was so obvious. Well, it wasn't so obvious until I read it from Nozick. And I have always been fascinating with that kind of, hey, let's, that kind of trial and error, and let's try new alternatives and let's see if this works. And particularly in small environments that, you know, the whatever damage or success, you know, can also be contained, and it's very easy to see. What I always think, and this is just, let's say, my way of thinking, and I'm sure there are a million reasons why to do something like this. I always like to think of let's say, what Nozick was proposing, and now of these alternative governance alternatives, structures and regions. I think they should never be a place for retreat. It's not. I come from Latin America, and from, you know, a couple of decades now in Argentina, in other places probably before, you started seeing the phenomenon of private neighborhoods. They are called countries in, you know, like country club, you know, something like that. But it's like a neighborhood in. But that is not, you know, that is not society rebelling. That is the last thing you could do before either you left the country or, you know, you're totally defeated. It's not an act of rebellion. It's not an act of an active. It's just the state has failed. There's nothing I can do. Of course, there are people end up in those places in part because of trying to look for more personal security, try to hide from criminality. You end up living in a place that, you know, there's a security guard that knows exactly when you enter, when you leave, who you do, who you came in and out, you know, who's your lover probably, you know, and everything like that. So I don't know how secure is that. I like to think of this, let's say, I think the best thing, in talking about Latin America, that Prospera, I think it's a great project, and the best thing it could do is to become like a lighthouse, like, you know, for Honduras and then from the rest of the region, saying there's another way. You see, it's not the problem of Latin Americans. It's not the problem of people from Honduras. No, the issue was the kind of institutional relationships and structures that they were put in. If you create something better, the results will be totally better. And I always like to think, and I think the best outcome that these new governance systems could bring is that it's been like in a way a defiance, and also like a role model, not a place that we go to hide and, you know, try to do on our own thing. I never liked this, and sorry for, you know, I don't want to hurt anybody's sensitivities. But I never liked this idea of, you know, of Atlas Shrugged, that, you know, talented people and, you know, creative people go and hide in, you know, in a nice place while everything burns. There is no, by the way, there is no certainty that after Manhattan collapses, you would come back as a, John Galt will come up as a savior. Probably in Manhattan, there will be some sort of Idi Amin, you know, from the Lower East, who will kill him and eat him. You know, it's not going to be greeted as the great savior. I think I'm never in favor of chaos. I'm never in favor of, you know, let everything burn, as long as I don't think that's sustainable. And I really think these new structures of governance should really be trying to become more and more popular, make people know the successes they are achieving, and be a force for change.
It's interesting talking about private neighborhoods, because there is a similarity even between Prospera and a private neighborhood. So what would your solution then be to the problem of security, for example. I agree. You don't want to be, you know, you don't want to live in a compound. But that by then, by the notion of something like that, a lot of people who would subscribe to those places probably want the property they own to be protected. I mean, that's the essence of property rights, right? So what's your, what would your solution be in that case?
I think the private, I don't see, I understand there are certain, let's say, parallelisms you could maybe find between a place like Prospera and a place like a private neighborhood. But I think those are, in they are very shallow. Prospera is a new experiment. It's a new, let's say, it's a completely different kind of institutional arrangement that is trying to achieve something. The private neighborhoods in Argentina are the best room in the Titanic. So that is, the, you know, it's comfortable. Maybe you have someone, you know, playing the violin or something like that. They bring you, you know, champagne and oysters, but you're going down. You're not doing anything radically different from the rest of the country. Some of them, and this is, you know, let's say even aesthetically, you know, it tells you something. Some of them are surrounded by slums, by favelas, but what we call villas miseria. Nothing is going on there that it's better or it's an improvement or it's just, you know, people with means, not necessarily, you know, mega rich, you know, just people with means trying to get the best places in the best cabinets in the Titanic. They are not doing something different. They are just trying to survive. I understand. Please, I understand. I'm not judging them because of this. But that is not something that is going to bring any change. If Prospera delivers what we think is going to deliver, the potential impact for that, for the rest of Honduras, the rest of Central America, and the rest of the Americas and the world, is massive. If I go and show you some middle class guy living in a nice house surrounded by slums and, you know, just suffering exactly everything the same as all of us suffer, but just, you know, he lives in a nice place that apparently is secure when you are surrounded by guards who you don't know who the hell they are. That is not something like Prospera.
I get it. There's no innovation happening in a private gated community. You're right. You're absolutely right. I've been to Prospera and it's true. It's an innovation hub. There's no question about it. I mean, it's exactly what it is. It's there to attract innovation, quite literally. So it's something I'm sure you... So I had a quick question, actually, about when we were talking about what your company does. You said you create indexes. Is that indexes of innovation? Is that like, if I want to know where are the best places to go for innovation or the best, I don't know, the best innovations in a particular field, is that what they are?
Not right now. We have, I mean, there are certain, you know, indexes that are very good. If you want to know which country is more innovative than another one, there are those tools have been, you know, there are good things that you can, you know, you can access already. So no, those are not the things we are currently working. We have worked, for instance, in the past, in an index for cities in Latin America regarding the sharing economy. We tried to be both innovative, but and also with a very easy to grasp and understand human impact. Quantum computing, I think it's amazing. Probably I don't fully understand it.
Me neither.
But it's not that, you know, my grandmother wakes up thinking about quantum computing, you know, you know, and how wonderful it's and the potential. But, you know, when you understand how great it is, that particularly when you are old enough to know how was it when we were, you know, prey of the taxi cartel, and now you have other options, and you can literally call, you press a button in your phone. Well, you press the screen of your phone, better said, and a car shows up and things like that. Those things are amazing. So we try always to combine that. So we've been working. One of the indexes we have produced in the past has to do with the sharing economy in different cities in Latin America. Unfortunately, in many cases, these alternatives are either banned or heavily regulated. Nowadays, in the most populated province of Argentina, they are trying to unionize the guys who work for Uber Eats, Glovo, etc., which they are ferociously opposing, by the way, but you know, politicians have other ideas. So, well, that's why we thought it was interesting to measure and see what was going on there, because you could see that there were many cities in Brazil doing it very well, and in Argentina not so much, a lot of things, products banned, and services banned. That's one of the indexes we have created. We're currently working in one regarding sustainable mobility, but very much related. It's not going to be only that, but very much related with all the alternatives that exist now regarding micro-mobility.
What does that mean? Scooters and stuff like that?
Scooters, but also the apps and many other alternatives. You can now literally, you know, rent a car per minute. You can rent a bike. So we want to really focus on all those, which are definitely more sustainable, but also totally innovative. And again, they are usually in the, let's say, they have a target on their backs for many reasons. And another thing that we have worked a lot is regarding how innovative products now have put us at the gates of eliminating smoking as we know it. And this has to do basically with alternatives to smoking cigarettes like vaping and others. There are several. And that is the kind, let's say, of innovation that we like. The one that not only is extremely innovative, but also has deep human impact. There are, let's say, more than a billion people who still smoke. Prohibition or the traditional therapies that we know, they have not delivered the results that we thought they would. And we have now here in Europe the case of a country like Sweden, which is about to achieve the status of smoke-free. That means that less than 5% of their adult population smokes. And you can use, when you see the stats, the statistics about, you know, throat cancer, lung cancer, and any all the diseases related to smoking tobacco, they are 40, 50, 60% lower than the European Union. We're not comparing, if you compare to other countries, it would be like 90% less, but compared to the average of the European Union. And it's very interesting that it's not that nicotine consumption lowered. What lowered was burning tobacco to consume nicotine. Swedish have this very now historic innovation, which is snus, which was some sort of tobacco powder that you put on your gum. And now there are other alternatives which I use.
I thought that gave you mouth cancer, though.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
No, it's one of the disfigure. Unfortunately, there are a lot of disfigurations and myths regarding all these things that either from the mouth cancer, from the snus to vaping, the vaping devices exploding, and things like that. No, they are not the case. And really, the stats of Sweden regarding smoking related diseases are amazing.
It reminds me of the expression criticized by creation. I like it's basically the same thing. A couple of last questions before we go, because we have to leave, apparently, I'm told. What's your favorite, most inspiring, most exciting innovation that you've come across recently? Maybe something I may not have heard of, or like was it like, I'm really excited by AI at the moment, obviously, like everyone is. It's almost a bit overwhelming, but it's easy to talk about. Every time I get up in the morning and I'm like, oh my God, I want to show someone this. This is incredible, you know. What's your favorite innovation, you know, that you come in contact with?
That's a very good, I would say the MetaHuman technology. Mm. We've been using it and it's what we are doing. I mean, please, I'm sure what we are doing is quite basic, but it's still amazing. For instance, one of the things we've done is we are doing an event in Sweden in a couple of days, and we'll be presenting an opinion study that we commissioned. So we created a script for a video and to present the results. And we have done it already. It's already prepared and ready to be launched. One in English, and the other one we translated into Swedish, and we just asked one of our Swedish partners to take a look to see if it sounded Swedish, because sometimes, you know, DeepL is great, but, you know, sometimes minor corrections, and we just put it to another MetaHuman to read it completely in Swedish, and we have the same video done. The potential of that is amazing, and we can reach people that we could never... I mean, I don't speak Swedish. As you can imagine, no one in almost no one in We Are Innovation speaks Swedish. And the potential of that, and that we and all this process...
I mean,
it was 2 hours.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that through. You could literally transform this conversation into 100 languages while you're asleep at night and then put them all out. It's almost too much to think about, and it's absolutely mind-boggling.
And we could create our own metahumans with our voices. Well, and we could have this conversation in Swedish, Japanese, Spanish. You know, we created.
Yeah, can you imagine us doing it in Spanish? In Japanese, that would be quite funny. It's interesting though. Like, this is a true story, but there's a podcast I listen to. It's a Bitcoin podcast, and a few episodes ago, they. Something happened to the sound and the actual mic stopped working, but they were filming it, so they got sound through the camera, but it wasn't good enough. And last I heard, they were basically getting because the podcast host has done hundreds of thousands of hours of podcasting, so they basically got they're going to get the script digitized, which we already do on this podcast, is very easy, and then an avatar is going to speak with better sound. I mean, really, it's just mind-boggling, the potential. I know what you mean. It's absolutely astonishing what's just about to happen. I'm excited and overwhelmed at the same time, because it's just too much that I feel like I could do now. I almost get that nervous creativity feeling where it's like, my God, you know, I need to be doing this. I need to be doing this. And it's almost like sometimes that can stop you doing anything, because you're just, by the time I've just got my head around creating summaries of our conversations with AI. And it took a little while to work out how to do it. And already now, I should be doing something else. I should be having a translator. We should have Japanese listeners already. And I'm like, Jesus, I got, you know. Anyway, okay, last question. This is our traditional question we ask everyone. You have a one-year sabbatical. It's all paid for. Someone's paying for you. What do you do in your 1 year?
That's a very good question. I mean, at this point of my life, you know, I couldn't think of not working for 1 year. So I think I would continue working probably from Prague. That's where I
go. You just move. Fair enough. I mean, you could, your benefactor would probably give you a very nice apartment for a year.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Federico, it's been awesome talking to you. I'm disappointed that we've only had an hour, because we could have talked for ages. But I hope we have another time, because I'd like to continue this conversation. I'm a huge fan of innovation in whatever realm it is, and you're a good orator. I really enjoyed talking to you. So thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for the invitation, and happy to be with you, and hopefully we'll have a second chance soon.